Hello and welcome to another episode of Pakistanomy. My name is Uzair Yunus. And if I told you we're going to be talking about a country that has had a dictatorship, just had elections, the elections were contested, the opposition is looking to go to the courts to contest the results of the elections, social media played a big role. You probably, knowing this podcast, might be thinking I'm going to talk about Pakistan and its elections on February 8th, but today we're going to be talking about Indonesia and its elections on February 14th, about a week right after Pakistan held its elections. And all of the things that I just described that sound quite relevant to many of those of you who follow Pakistani politics were part of the story in Indonesia as well. And if that wasn't enough, well, just like Pakistan, Indonesia has a long and at times tortured history with the United States. It has had growing Chinese influence, a lot of questions about Chinese influence as well. So the story is quite similar. In fact, a few months ago, I wrote a comparative piece in Dawn about Indonesia's democratic transition and what Pakistan could learn from that as well. So we're going to be talking about Indonesia's elections, what happened, who are the characters, what comes next, how does foreign policy shift, with my colleague Mehu Sitepu, who is an associate at the Asia Group. We work together at the same place. And when I've been meaning to have this conversation for a while, but the Pakistan elections were so crazy that we had to keep delaying it a bit. But I'm glad we finally have this chance to talk about it. Mehu is somebody who has vast experience in Indonesia. She has over a decade's experience as a journalist in Indonesia, worked for 3 years as a senior role at the BBC, has interviewed the president of Indonesia, various ministers, knows a lot of the various characters in the country. So we're going to have an in-depth conversation about me understanding and all of you who are tuning in, understanding what happened in Indonesia and what comes next. So Mehu, thank you so much for taking out the time and welcome to Pakistanomy.
Thank you, Uzair, for inviting me. It's a pleasure to introduce my country. A lot of people say that it's a very misunderstood country. So thank you for letting me explain about my country and show like how we're actually very similar in so many ways, as you explain.
Well, let's jump right in. So, you know, many of the listeners of this podcast are in Pakistan. A lot of them are in India, or they follow the politics of South Asia, less so Southeast Asia. So give us all a quick 101 about the elections, the backdrop of the elections, and what the cast of characters, so to say, look like in the run-up to the elections. And then we'll go into the elections and what happened after that.
Sure. Okay. So first of all, if we're going to talk about the election, I have to tell you about the incumbent president, President Joko Widodo, that we called him fondly as President Jokowi. So President Jokowi, this is his last year in the office, because Indonesia's constitution only allowed him, or only allow any president to stay in the office for 2 terms maximum, i.e. for 10 years, because 1 term lasts for 5 years. So during his last 9 years in the office, he's done amazing thing in terms of, like, you know, building infrastructure. A lot of people call him as the infrastructure in chief. The economy during his administration done really well. Even during COVID, I don't think we've ever had any recession. So people are happy with him. And so even on his last year in the office, his approval rating is still 80%. Can you imagine? That is
almost like Narendra Modi in India at that
level. I guess. Yes. Yeah, exactly. So, and in general, he's not controversial, because he never really used, you know, identity-based politics during his office. That's why people love him. And he came from, just like, he was a regular people. He wasn't an elite politics. So he wasn't someone who came from, you know, whose father who owns whatever. No, he was like someone who used to live in a tiny shed in a tiny a small city in Java. So, you know, he's kind of like a nobody becomes somebody. And so people relate to him, to his journey in the politics, but at the same time, what people doesn't know is that he's actually is amazing politician, and that's why he can managed to maintain his image as this amazing, you know, personality that people still loved him, even though people still love him even on the last months of his administration. So that is the main issue, or like the main character in this election. You might think, like, why? He's an outgoing president, but why are we still talking about him? That's because this is the thing. So in his last campaign, two campaigns to become a president, he always have to challenge this former general coming from the elite family. His father was like one of Indonesia's ministries, and he's this general, his what you call it, former in-law, father-in-law, was Indonesia's former dictator for 30 years. So, you know, he has been in Indonesia's, you know, elite scene for so long. And he's always wanted to be a president. This guy's name's Prabowo Subianto. And he's been trying to become a president because he really thinks that it's not his birthright, but it's something that he has to do. It's kind of like I think he really believes that he's destined to become a leader.
Because he comes from the right background, and his father-in-law was the dictator and ruled Indonesia and all of that.
Yeah. Plus, I really think that his father also instilled that ideology. Interestingly, like, his father was actually Indonesia's first socialist party leader. So it's interesting because, like, his father, as a finance ministry, has this very unique view, you know, balancing capitalism and also socialism, because his father was trained in the U.S. in I think Berkeley, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, so have like this Western kind of like thinking, you know, supporting capitalism, but at the same time, you have to, you know, provide for the people. So anyway, back to Prabowo. He's been trying to become a president for so long. So this year, this election is his third try. So the last two tries, he's always lost to Jokowi, because again, people are tired, you know, from the elites. I guess the same thing, like, you know, in the US as well, right? Like,
why? Yeah, it's the Trump same in the US, it's the same in Pakistan, it's the same
exactly.
In India. Narendra Modi was a tea seller, comes from nothing, doesn't have legacy like Gandhi in Pakistan, as I was sort of saying, alluding to in the introduction. Imran Khan is in jail, and he's sort of not been allowed to run in a free or fair election. But despite that, his party emerged as the largest party. They did not form the main government, the central government. But when you talk to average Pakistanis, especially young Pakistanis, they say, I don't like the dynast. Why is it that the right last name gives you this right to win an election? And it's the same sentiment in India with Narendra Modi and Rahul Gandhi. Same sentiment we saw in America in 2016, right? Nobody wants another Clinton.
Yeah.
Like, why? Just because you're a Clinton means you can rule over us? No, we're not going to tolerate that. So very similar across the world.
Exactly. I love that you mentioned that. So, yeah. It's very similar. People basically do not want to vote for, did not want to vote for Prabowo because of his like elite background and his legacy background. And they keep voting for Jokowi. And yeah, the fact that Jokowi can actually did a good job as a president. So third time a charm for Prabowo this year. He tried again. And
spoiler alert, you just gave a spoiler. Third time a charm. We'll get to his win
that's
in a bit.
True. Yeah, sorry about that. But the interesting part, can you imagine, like, they've been rivals for two election cycle, but this election cycle, something is different. Something happened that Jokowi decided to give his son to become Prabowo's VP. So Jokowi, you know, negotiating with Prabowo and says, like, you know, why don't you go with my run with my son? I think Jokowi really understand that he still has a lot of, you know, he's still very popular. He still can convey, you know, the public to vote for him, quote unquote, indirectly through his son. And a lot of people are confused on like, why now you are, you know, decided to become, it becomes like, you know, phobic that become friends, right? Like you decide, you were like, you were rivals, but now you decided to be like in you know, in a group to basically making sure that your son is in power so that you indirectly still in power. So basically that's what happened this election. Prabowo run with Jokowi's son. Jokowi's son has become the VP. Jokowi's son, he's only 36 years old. I'm not saying that you can't be a leader at such young age, but so just to become a VP candidate, Jokowi have to navigate Indonesia's you know, law. So basically, the son, so Indonesia's constitutional court has to pass a law that allows Jokowi's son to be able to run for VP, because before the constitution basically said that in order for someone to run as a VP, he or she has to be at least 40 years old. And Jokowi's son named Gibran is only 36 years old.
And what was he doing before coming into the nomination as VP? What was his job?
He was a mayor of Solo. Solo is where the family came from. So Jokowi came from Solo. And so Jokowi is very popular in Solo. And that's why when the son ran in that city as a mayor, it's very easy for him to win the city.
So would it be, if I may interrupt you, right, would it be fair to then say that what Jokowi is trying to do essentially is build an alliance with his former rival, who comes from an elite background, to get that elite behind him and his son, not only to rule indirectly, but also like his son, who was a mayor of a city that his hometown, now is a shot to be a VP. And to me, at least as an outsider, I think Jokowi wants his son at one point in time to be the president. And this is a good way to get his son in the lineup to be president by becoming VP in this election. Would it be fair to see it that way?
I think it's, if he's going to do that, I think it's going to be like in the long run. I think this is my analysis personally. So during his last, this couple of years, so Jokowi, he's actually a member of a Indonesian Democratic Party of Struggle. We call it PDIP. So it's the biggest party right now with the most seats in the parliament. So it's the most popular. It's also the most popular because it's Jokowi's party. But the relationship between Jokowi and the party's leader has been strained for the last couple of years. And so I think Jokowi wanted to have a political capital even after he leave the office. And in Indonesia, without having a party, that's very difficult, because I think what Jokowi, this is my very personal opinion, but when I talk to a lot of people agree with this. So during his time in the office, Jokowi made a lot of enemies because he wants everything to be super efficient, because he knows like he only have limited time to make like his vision come true. And a lot of his vision does come true, and that's why he's still very popular. But because he's the guy who's like, do it. If you cannot do it, you're out. So a lot of people who has helped him along the way felt, you know, disrespected. and basically become his enemies. So it's so interesting because a lot of his political enemies used to become his allies at the beginning of his political journey. So I think what happened is that why he really wants to have a political capital by securing his son as a VP candidate is because he is afraid that in the future, something's going to bite back at him or someone's going to bite back at him. As I mentioned, he built a lot of infrastructure. Some people probably use that infrastructure project as, you know, something to get after him, because that's also the thing about Indonesia law. You, as a leader with your decision maker, you can actually send to court for corruption if your project, you know, lose money. So
sounds quite familiar to me.
Really? Is it also similar to Pakistan?
It's the national accountability laws in
Correct.
Pakistan that, like, you know, for example, just to give you context, the one of the former finance ministers and the former prime ministers who used to be the petroleum minister, when they were in power, they did some projects, right? And after 2018, when the government changed, both of them found themselves in jail for weeks on end because of corruption charges on deals that they had supervised. And it was like, there was no evidence, but because they were the ministers, they were just picked up and put in jail. Also, they happened to be critics of the new government. And so this was a convenient way to force them to shut up.
Oh my God. I'm shocked of like how similar the country, this country is. So yeah, exactly. So I know that he understands that people are gonna, you know, go after him after he left, and that's why he needs to secure any political capital, and he uses his son for
okay,
that.
Okay, so you have Prabowo Gibran as one ticket. Who's running
Yes.
against him? What's the opposition?
So the opposition is actually this this guy from the PDIP party. So,
oh, interesting. So the president's own party is running against his son. Interesting.
Yes, exactly. Because I told you, like, the relationship with the party leader has been strained. And the party leaders literally said, like, I'm not going to be, you know, played by you. So the party leader is a she. And she's also, like, our first female president. So he's a former president. So she basically let one of her popular one of her popular members to become one of the candidates. His name's Ganjar. Ganjar decided to run with Indonesia's coordinating minister of law, a professor of law, very well respected. His name's Mahfud. And so initially, Ganjar is actually leading the polls. And the third candidate is this, like I mentioned, you know, the foe that the friends that become foe. So, you know, once Jokowi's education minister, but then they fell apart. And then this guy become his enemy. His name is Anies Baswedan. And Anies ran with the leader of Indonesia's largest Muslim party, and we call him Iman, from Muhaymin. So yeah, so those are the three pairs. The Anies and Muhaymin camp, they have a very strong message against Jokowi. And so they have a clear, you know, type of voters, people who doesn't like Jokowi, and also people who is, you know, conservative Muslim might
and
vote
what's the broader theme? Like, what's the Anies ticket arguing for? Like, I get the conservative Muslim voter point, but what's the critique of Jokowi? Like, what are they coming at?
The critic of Jokowi is mainly about his economic policies. What he says is that, oh yeah, infrastructure, you're building things. You're building roads, but you're not building the people. You know, a lot of people are still, in dire poverty level. A lot of people doesn't have the educations that they need. A lot of people, still being left out. So they use that kind of like populist rhetoric, like if you're not happy with the current government, I'm with you. So that's basically like his main message. So, anything criticizing of like government Jokowi's economic policies and also the conservative Muslim.
Okay,
That's
so
their voter
that's the
base.
Anis side, and then what's Ganjar? Now that already, if I'm looking at it again from the outside, that's kind of tough to for a third candidate to have a message, because you have the president's choice on one end. Obviously, that's continuity, and he's popular. And oh, by the way, the president is on the wannabe president is the third time. The charm comes from the elite family. You have the other side that you just explained, Anis arguing for more conservative voters, people being left behind. So what's Ganjar arguing for? How is he splitting the vote?
So that's a thing. So Ganjar's main voter. So initially Ganjar came as like, oh, we're going to continue Jokowi's economic policy because, he's coming from the same party of Jokowi's, right? So it's going to be weird if he start critiquing Jokowi. And also, as I mentioned at the beginning, he was Jokowi's friend in the party. But then because Jokowi decided to have like his son run with Prabowo with the elite, like all people who initially voted for Ganjar decided to move and voted to Prabowo because they can actually see that, oh, even though Ganjar and Jokowi were close, but who Jokowi really support is actually his son with Prabowo. So that's why I said like initially Ganjar's popularity is actually the highest, but then during the election, the results shows that he's actually have the least votes because as you mentioned, it's difficult. Like how do you differentiate yourself with Jokowi's son, especially because you have like the same party and the same message as well. We're going to continue Jokowi's policy. But this is also the thing. This is Indonesia's politics 101. In Indonesia, personality matters rather than ideology. Because, even like in political parties, there's not a big ideology difference between one political parties to another. Indonesia's political parties is mainly divided by the identity. So that's why, like for example, Indonesia has a number of Muslim political Muslim parties. And even for the Muslim parties, there are like the more conservative Muslim, the more liberal a Muslim party, and the younger Muslim party. So it's like varies. Like PDIP voters is mainly the more liberal secular people. Parties normally they don't have like a big difference on ideology. It's mainly just like who in Indonesia's population that they want to tap in, like in terms of demography. So that's why within or like during this election, it's difficult to just like say I prefer Jokowi because he's or I prefer Ganjar because he has defended A, B, C, or D, because at this point people will just look at like his personality.
Yeah, so that's very interesting. So thanks for giving that backdrop, right? And now the question I had in my mind, actually, I get a lot more clarity about the role of social media, because I remember I talked to you about this as well. I was sort of loosely following the news. It was like TikTok played a big role. Prabowo was able to sort of, even though he's older, how old is he? Something 70 something, or
76,
yeah,
if I'm not mistaken.
He's an older boomer essentially, which is again very similar to what politics is in many parts of the world. But he used social media to connect with younger voters. At least that's what I read. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. But what role did technology play Because again, to me, now it makes sense. It's a very contested space. Ideology doesn't really matter. Personality does. So technology and social media obviously is a great way to differentiate yourself. So tell us a bit about Prabowo's strategy on social media and how was he able to connect with younger Indonesians in this election?
Yeah, I think what's important to highlight is that the majority of the voters for this election, so I think like more than 50% is actually age below 35 years old. So, a very young voter base. And so like how do you convey your messages to these people? I guess the easiest way is through social media. The thing with like Prabowo is that Prabowo has a reputational issues. So a little bit of background in the history of Indonesia. In 1998, there is a reform movement, we call it Reformasi, where we toppled down Prabowo's former father-in-law regime. So back in the 1998, we toppled down the dictatorship regime under Suharto, and during that time, there was a lot of riots and basically just unease everywhere. And so Prabowo, he was the leader of Indonesia's special forces, and I believe the CIA believed that he was the guy behind the kidnapping of a lot of human rights activists during that period. A lot of human rights activists during this period got kidnapped, and then some of them returned, but a lot of them basically never returned home. So a lot of people assumed that they died. And the CIA released a report believing that Prabowo is the guy behind that. And that's why Prabowo, for so long, cannot come visit America because he's blacklisted. And so he can only back to the US under his formal position as a defense minister. And so,
Interesting.
yes. So, but this happened back in 1998, so almost 20 years ago. A lot of people, even though we put this in the history book, a lot of people don't read history, don't like history. They don't know
Well,
that
if
this
you're
guy.
30 something years old, you probably, yeah, what happened 25 years ago? Don't really know.
Exactly, right? And so, because of that, what he tried to do is that he tried to create a new persona, and that's why he used social media. And in social media, he's like dancing, and like there is what's called like Prabowo dance, and people start copying his dance because like that's what TikTok is for. There's a lot of like dancing videos. So he used this kind of like new personality as a cuddly grandpa. To show that, I am very personable, and I am not what people accuse me of as, as a kidnapper or human rights abuser. So he used social media to basically come up with a new personality. And I think this technique has been used also during the President Marcos of the Philippines he ran for president, because like President Marcos has the very similar history. I don't know if you're aware about his history. Yeah. So yeah, you reinvent your image through social media basically, and it
Because it's
works.
a younger population who's not fully familiar with everything that happened, it's relatively easier to create a new brand, so to speak.
Correct. Yes, 100%. The same thing with Marcos as well, because like when he's when the President Marcos Senior, have like the corruption scandal, I think like it was what 20, 30 years ago that younger people nowadays didn't know what happened. Yeah, it's
Interesting. So
interesting.
that's how social media was used, and I guess Prabowo was much better at sort of tapping into its full power and redefining his own brand, connecting with people. So then tell us about elections. Like obviously you gave the spoiler, Prabowo wins, but You know, I was just catching up right before this recording just to get a sense of what happened after as well, because I basically tuned out. Seems like people are still contesting the results. So tell us about what the allegations, what the results were, how close was it? And then what are these allegations that are still being made? And I saw a headline that the opponents are trying to go to court to contest. So give us an overview of what happened and what's going on.
Yes. So the opponents basically saying there's a lot of like vote rigging during the election, which I wouldn't say, you know, it's not factual, but Indonesia's election is also one of the most transparent election that I've known. So during the election, and during the vote counting, you will have to basically, every vote stations will need to have a number of witnesses. So it's very transparent. You cannot just say like, oh, you know, even though like the election is done manually, you know that the committee in that vote stations, they cannot just like make up numbers because there are
So
witnesses attend.
in Pakistan, that's exactly what happened. And the witnesses were kicked out of the polling stations. And then given the form they were given ended up having a different count than the form that was finally published by the Election Commission. That's a different story. You can listen to that podcast. I did a coverage with one of the candidates in the National Assembly who sort of is contesting the results. And that's exactly what happened. There were witnesses. He was given a certain set of documents, but then the documents that were the full compilation that was then put up, the count was different. So now he's contesting it. So, okay, Indonesia doesn't happen like that. That is transparent.
Well, so I haven't heard anyone about any stories about like witnesses being thrown out, but a lot of like irregularities or like mismatch between the forms and what's published, yes, there are.
Okay, so
But
very
the
simple. Okay.
election, yes, but the Election Commission said like it's just, you know, technical glitches. So it doesn't mean that we're changing the numbers. It's just like, you know, the difference between what's reported in the form and what they reported like publicly online, there are differences just because of technical glitches and not because they purposely do it. That's what the Election Commission said. But I think the biggest issue at play is that during the election, because Prabowo is a defense minister and because Jokowi is, you know, a president, they actually use a lot of like state facilities to support the campaign. So I think that's where the ethical problem arose. And so I think this is what the contenders will use as one of their biggest challenge if they want to bring it to the court, because it's very difficult to find cases and then you bring it to the court and say like, you know, this is invalid. You know, you can, especially because Prabowo won by a landslide. He got 59% of votes, while I think Anies get about 20 something percent.
Oh wow, so the
And
gap is too huge.
it's too huge. So I don't think they can, I don't think like, even though they say like, oh, you know, we found irregularities here and there, I don't think they will be able to close the gap.
So the
So, yeah.
argument they will make, as you were saying, is that they will try to argue that there was not a level playing field because the government was sort of tipping the scales by using its capabilities to help Prabowo and the president's son, who's the VP.
Exactly, yes. And is it allowed according to our constitution? I don't know.
The courts will decide.
Because,
Okay.
yeah, the court will decide.
Okay, interesting. So now I want to spend the last few minutes of this conversation, Mehu, to sort of like, you know, have your analysis on what changes in Indonesia, right? Again, as I said at the intro, a lot of similarities as we've talked about, but also on foreign policy side, right? Dictatorships in Indonesia. I've read some history close to the United States, you know, Cold War era Pakistan was very similar dictatorships. The American government to this day, is much more comfortable dealing with the Pakistani military as opposed to civilian Democrats. The Democrats like to speak their mind. Western countries don't really like politicians who like to speak their minds in our part of the world a lot of times. So that leads to a weird relationship and dynamic. But then also, like Pakistan, from what I've read, Chinese influence has grown in Indonesia in recent years as well, particularly around critical minerals and infrastructure development, etc. So what's the relationship like right now between Indonesia and, let's say, the United States and China? And what is the foreign policy outlook when it comes to these topics for the incoming president, assuming the courts say nothing doing, he's going to be the president?
Yes. So defense minister, so Prabowo, he's a Western educated person. So he spent most of his time studying in the UK. He's very pro-West in terms of a lot of things. But he also understands that Indonesia has to balance the, you know, our relationship with the US and also with China, especially because China is so much closer than the US. And he can see it as a very, you know, viable risk. So having a, you know, a defense minister as an upcoming president, I think he's going to have a lot of defense perspective in that sense. So I think he will try to be friendly to the to China, especially for economic purposes. But I really believe that he prefers to ally with the US or the West for defense purposes. Because there are several instances where I think he came to the US two times recently to buy some F-15s and planning to buy some F-35s as well, if I'm not mistaken. Like he is, you know, he relies a lot to the US for any defense capabilities. And so again, I really see that he will try to build and rebuild a relationship, I guess, after what happened for the last 20 years, you know, being banned to the US. And especially, but it will take two to tango. If the US wants to do the same effort to him, I think it will highly reciprocate. And so I think what he's going to do is that he's going to make sure there's a strong allyship with the West in terms of like defense, but maintaining, you know, the economic preference to China.
Okay. And I want to say that's a good part. I had a follow up on this. So economic preference to China, obviously infrastructure, there's been a lot of coverage in terms of Chinese investments in Indonesia. But another thing that I've read about is like areas around critical minerals, right? Battery manufacturing, nickel, things like that. And in President Jokowi's time, from what I've seen from the outside, has been this push towards increased processing of these critical minerals in Indonesia, more value addition domestically, looking at using that basic mineral at home to do more and build more things. But of course, if you're looking at, as you described, an incoming president who's pro-West and wants to buy American military gear, given Indonesia's access to critical minerals and its own, you know, mining capabilities, that also is part of the growing U.S.-China strategic competition. In fact, more than weapons, it's the action is on the mineral side and on these types of things. So where do you see that strategy going, given that the Chinese are so dominant and closer and influential in these sectors? How will he seek to balance that out, given that it's very clear, you and I are both in Washington, the China plus one or de-risking from China is going to be a major, major part, even in the United States, regardless of who wins the elections this year. So what's Prabowo going to do or is potentially going to do on the econ side? What are going to be his flagship policies there?
I think he's at the same time very pragmatic as individual. He knows that Jokowi's policy works. The reason why Jokowi's critical mineral policy works, I don't know if you know that Jokowi has actually banned the export of raw nickel. And that's why all the Chinese companies and also South Korean and Japan, Japanese companies, they have to come to Indonesia and build their EV or battery production in Indonesia because they cannot get their nickel sources elsewhere. Indonesia is the largest nickel producer. And during his campaign, Prabowo said that he's actually going to expand that export ban into 21 other commodities. That means that he really wants, companies to come and build Indonesia's industries in domestically. And I think it will have a lot of issues with the West, especially, Indonesia's main trade is our commodity. So if you're banning that commodity export, then I think it will be, there will be a challenge, at least from the Western countries. The issues with the Western countries is that they have a very strong environmental policies. So Jokowi actually has been courting Tesla for 2 years. So since 2021, since he had like this vision to make Indonesia as the next, critical mineral center or hub in Southeast Asia, he's been courting Tesla to basically bring Tesla to Indonesia. But Tesla decided to say no because Tesla said like Indonesia's nickel processing is too dirty and he don't want to risk it with his investors. I think it's going to be very difficult if Indonesia doesn't improve its environmental and labor practices while expecting to have like this huge industrialization push by creating this export ban. But at the same time, as I mentioned, Prabowo is very pragmatic. So he's gonna do what he thinks is going to, bring in money, but less risky. So it's basically just, as I think, like as a defense minister, as a former general, he knows how to do calculated risk. So I think he's gonna see like how not to piss the West, but still can bring investment in to the country.
Got it. That's interesting. And last follow up on this, how do the Chinese view him? Like, what are his views on China and its influence in the region? You said he's sort of been educated in the West, wants to buy military gear. So I would assume that the Chinese have some concerns. But what are you following in terms of his views on China?
Well, let's just say I don't really see any, concerns like, major concerns coming from China. But I mean, out of the three candidates, I know he's not the most favorite for the Chinese. Prabowo, again, like he's a calculated man. He is a former general. I know that he can play his role because I know one of his thing is that he really wants to bring Indonesia into the international level. So like Jokowi is a very inward looking president. So he only focused on domestic issues, while Prabowo is someone who's happy to go to Raisina every year or Shangri-La Dialogue in Singapore. So he wants to have that, international personality. So he knows not to, make enemies with the Chinese and make the West happy at the same time.
Interesting. So he'll strike the balance, and he's somebody who likes the spotlight. So we're going to see and hear more of him compared to Jokowi, because, I think I felt the same way. I was like, for Indonesia, its size, its economic, impact, its interest in its linkages to the global commodities trade. You didn't hear a lot in international media about Jokowi. So it makes sense. You said he's inward looking. So now it adds up. And so we'll see more of Prabowo, assuming the election results goes through the courts, which I think it will as well, based on my reading. Before I let you go, this question I ask every guest of mine, what are two or three books you recommend to the audience? And it can be on any topic, but maybe a couple, one or two on Indonesia would help.
Yes, of course. I mean, when I think about it, it's very difficult to narrow down to three, but my recommendations will all link to Indonesia. So my first one would be Indonesia, Etc. by Elizabeth Pisani. Elizabeth Pisani was a former journalist with Reuters, and she lived in Indonesia during Suharto's regime. And so it's very interesting for someone who didn't live through that period to actually read her account of like what's going on in the country. It's amazing. And because he was a journalist, he had like this, you know, firsthand account of like meeting the generals, also, you know, the former dictators. I think that's one of my most favorite book. If you want to learn about Indonesia politics or modern history, take a look of Indonesia, Etc. by Elizabeth Pisani. The second book that I will recommend is this, a novel by my favorite Indonesian author, and I think I am become, you know, one of the reasons why I become a feminist right now is because of like her books. I think she's one of the early feminist writer on her period. Her name is N.H. Dini. So her book called Departure, that one is in English, but I read all her book in Indonesia and it's amazing. And the last one is, this is my go-to book during COVID, because during COVID, I really miss Indonesian cooking and I have to learn to make it myself. And this book is by Sri Owen. It's Indonesian food. And Sri Owen was also a journalist. She was a journalist with the BBC in London. And her cooking book is basically a combination of recipes and also her stories about Indonesia. So yeah, I love it.
That's amazing. Thank you for all three recommendations. I will start with the Indonesian food book because I like to cook. So maybe this is my way to learn Indonesian food and how to make Indonesian food as well. Before I let you go, last to last question, since you raised it in the first comment, book you recommended, the role of the military. I should have asked this earlier, but what is the state of democracy in Indonesia like, and what is the role of the military now, decades after the end of dictatorship formally, but also, to me at least, as somebody who follows Pakistan much more closely, a democratic transition that has evolved in the right direction? What is the current way in which the military behaves in Indonesia?
I think, unfortunately, or probably fortunately, especially during Jokowi's administration, because he come from a civilian background, the military background is actually kind of like set aside in the picture. So we don't really hear or see a lot of military leaders becoming, you know, a leader of any institutions. During the previous administration, because the former president before Jokowi was a former general, so he came from military background, we still saw a lot of you know, military people having important or critical positions in the government, but not so much during Jokowi. And I think that's also one of the reasons why Prabowo failed to become president for two times, because I think people do not want to have another like military regime. So they are very cautious about that. And that's also why, you know, one of the reasons why Prabowo have to reinvent himself as a cuddly grandpa, because during his two failed attempts, he always bring himself as the strong man, a former general, the one that can beat Jokowi. It didn't work. Now he came as a cuddly grandpa. People love him. It works. So yeah, I think in summary, I think Indonesia really cautious and aware of like the military influence.
Interesting. I think that's a good step and a good thing to have, where civilians sort of over time get more of their space. So I'm glad Jokowi was able to do it, and that people themselves are skeptical of a growing footprint or strongman retired general type. So that's always good to hear from my point of view. Thank you so much for taking out the time. I know it's a Friday afternoon and you have a very busy schedule. So I appreciate you sharing your insights, giving us a 101 on Indonesian politics. And I think this was very educational for me and most definitely for our audience as well. So we'll stay in touch and keep talking, and maybe we'll see more of Indonesia's president on the international stage as the transition happens. So have a great day. Thank you so much, Mehul.
Thank you, Izar. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.